Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two segments today. First, in moments, Isabel Hilton, editor of ChinaDialogue.net, will tell us about what gyrations in the Chinese stock market mean. And then at the bottom of the hour, Chris Maizano, contributor to Jacobin magazine, will explain a legal challenge to public sector unionism now before the Supreme Court. The Chinese stock market, a phrase that still sounds odd to those of us who grew up trained to fear Red China, had a terrible summer, found some stability in the fall, and has had a relapse of its fainting disease in recent weeks. What does this mean for China and for the rest of the world? Here is Isabel Hilton, the London-based editor of ChinaDialogue.net, to explain. Isabel Hilton. The Chinese financial markets are in an uproar and sending shivers through the rest of the world's financial markets. Should the rest of the world be worried?
The rest of the world should not be worried in the sense of losing value, losing assets, losing investments, because the rest of the world's share in the Chinese stock market is minimal, really. The Chinese stock market is relatively new, and it doesn't look like other stock markets in a number of respects. One is that it has a very high proportion of retail investors, so ordinary people putting their savings in, relatively low share of institutional investors, and very little foreign participation. So a crash in the Chinese stock market isn't going to affect the share value of your portfolio in any meaningful way. Where you might be worried, and where perhaps you should be worried, is that a successful stock market was part of the Chinese government's strategy in the longer term of moving towards market instruments. It's the economic reform. It's the upgrading of the Chinese economy from low-end manufacture to higher value, more efficient, you know, more diverse economy with greater use of market instruments. And frankly, it's been a bit of a disaster. So it's knocked confidence in the Chinese authorities, and it hasn't done what it was meant to do, which was to provide finance for a burgeoning private sector in China. It's failed in both those respects, and it's really cost a lot of political capital to the Chinese leadership.
You already addressed one of my two questions, which was the role of the Chinese stock market providing corporate finance, which I gather is rather minor. But what about in corporate governance? Does it have any role in that at all?
Well, yes, it should have the same role in corporate governance that that Western stock markets have. But, you know, a lot of China's financial management is pretty untransparent. And I should just to clarify the question of corporate finance. The problem with finance in China and with credit in China is that it's been disproportionately directed to state-owned enterprises. So very feather-bedded, often very inefficient, but very large and powerful companies like the energy sector or, you know, the state grid or the oil business. Any state-owned enterprise access capital on tap. The company that didn't get access to capital, and certainly not on any favorable terms, were the private companies. So if you're a private entrepreneur in China, you had real difficulty accessing any kind of capital. And a lot of people turned to shadow banking, and they turned to credit unions. All kinds of ad hoc arrangements were made to provide the kind of capital to small entrepreneurs who sometimes became big entrepreneurs. But anyway, they had that problem. So the stock market was meant to fill that gap, if you like. And that's a problem for China if it doesn't do that, because China is trying to, you know, become a 21st century economy. It's trying to have, you know, high-level tech startups. It's trying to encourage innovation and entrepreneurship. None of those work, really, if private individuals and small businesses, small enterprises can't get access to capital. So that's the problem there. It's not that there wasn't corporate finance. It was just all going in the wrong direction, and still is.
What about the role of the stock market in corporate governance? As in, you know, Anglo-American markets, it's important for takeovers, mergers and acquisitions, the influence of shareholders on management. Do any of those criteria apply in the Chinese case?
Not really. I mean, you don't have big institutional shareholders in the same way. You know, it's not that you know, the way pension funds can influence shareholders or influence corporate boards in the West. That hasn't really been the function of the stock market. It's too new. It's too disparate. Small retail investors don't carry any weight. And it's also pretty, you know, it's a pretty casino kind of environment. You know, it's highly speculative, and it's, as we've seen, highly volatile. So, you know, there's quite a long way to go before this becomes any kind of trusted instrument, I think, in China, and certainly quite a long way to go before it has a positive influence on corporate governance. But also the biggest enterprises in China are still essentially state-owned enterprises, and so they are really run by their party committee. They're run for criteria and norms that are not necessarily responsive to any kind of shift in stock market value. You know, it's not, that's kind of not the basis of their existence. So the big levers of the Chinese economy don't really touch the stock market.
The reason that retail investors put their money in the market is just because they want to make a buck. I mean, it's really not highly informed investors we're talking about.
The retail investors are, you know, the people in China who save, the Chinese save a lot. And what do you do with your savings if you're Chinese? It's really hard if you're, you know, you can't, if you don't have access to, if you can't kind of smuggle money to the Cayman Islands or buy a flat in Manhattan or whatever. And so in China, what people have done with their savings, given that banks have effectively given a negative return for years, is that if they can afford it, they buy property on the understanding that the property market will go on going up forever. And that stopped happening a couple of years ago. People began to get really concerned. And then the government sent some really strong signals. It's going to be a really good source of you know, it was going to make you rich. Put your money in the stock market and it will grow and multiply. Now, when the government sends signals like that in China, people think the government is going to make this happen. So they put a lot of money into the stock market, and for a while it went very well. It went rocketing up until the summer, and then it started, you know, the bubble started to burst. That caused major panic. It caused major panic amongst the small investors, and it caused a certain amount of panic in the authorities, because that's a lot of angry citizens who felt cheated of the promise that they were going to get rich. So they started to try to control the trading on the stock market. And that really, you know, we're still in that cycle. We're still in that, you know, curious vision of a government that is supposed to be moving to the market, but it doesn't want to allow the market to fall. It doesn't want the risks that come with the market. It's too used to being able to control everything. So now it's trying to fix the market. And every time it tries, it gets worse.
Is the stock market tied very intimately with the rest of the Chinese financial system? Will banks go under because of this, or is this a symptom that the financial system is on a precipice, or are these, the stock market live in its own world?
The stock market is pretty much in its own world. It's still, as I say, a relatively small part of the economy. Now, the banks do have other problems, and there are real problems in the Chinese financial system. There, a lot of it is very large amounts of local government debt, which, you know, local governments borrowed against property. And property, you know, they don't really have a sound funding model for local governments. So they can't raise taxes. They don't have a property tax. They really are short of funds, and they have a lot of obligations. So the way that they've financed themselves in the past is to confiscate agricultural land, which they, you know, didn't have any trouble doing, to rezone it and then to build on it. So building business parks or industrial zones or residential property, and either selling that or borrowing against it. Then when the property market began to cool down, and there's a huge oversupply of residential property right now, and the general economy slowed, you know, those debts began to look pretty worrying. So you have 40% of China's GDP is in debt. It has a larger debt to GDP ratio than Greece has, actually. So there are a lot of problems. The second problem in the financial sector is shadow banking. Because people couldn't get investment in their businesses, they tended to go to a kind of grey banking network, which was pretty unregulated and which, again, has very large debts. And nobody quite knows what's going to happen when that starts to unravel, as it certainly will.
And now what about the real economy? That's been slowing. Is it on the verge of recession or worse?
I think it's quite a long way from recession. The slowing of the real economy that's not a cyclical phenomenon. That really is a, you know, this is here to stay. And if you look at the pattern of growth of other Asian tigers, you know, Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, Thailand, you know, they have this roaring rapid growth for 20 or 30 years, and then they price themselves out of the market, they become middle-income countries, or as China would put it, modestly prosperous, they start to run out of cheap labor. So all the competitive advantage which they have in the first couple of decades begins to wear out. China's at that point, and China's paid a very heavy price for its industrialization in terms of environmental pollution, air pollution, water pollution, every kind. And really, it's a strategic direction of China now is to have a cleaner, greener, more efficient, higher value economy. But that is slower growth. You know, you're not just pouring concrete and building infrastructure. That phase is pretty much over. And so the prediction was that it would come down to 7%. A lot of analysts think it's quite a lot below that. And of course, there are risks in this transition. But the transition itself, the fact that the Chinese economy is slowing as they try to make this transition, that should not be a surprise. They're trying to move to more domestic consumption, less investment, all those things that maturing economies have to do.
Well, we've been hearing about that for quite a long time. Are they actually beginning to make it?
Well, there's a certain amount of growth in consumption. That's true. Where they're not doing so well is in closing down excess capacity in things like steel and cement, which they really do need to do. But they're trying to export that surplus capacity rather than close it down. I'm not sure how well that's going to go, really. So, you know, it's slow and difficult. They have to get a lot more efficient. And they have to allow, you know, a lot more triage. I think, you know, quite a few organizations have to go bust. They've also got to get state-owned enterprises under control. So there are quite a lot of challenges here.
I'm speaking with Isabel Hilton, editor of ChinaDialogue.net. Now, what about the labor force? The population is aging, and the labor force is probably not growing very rapidly. Do they have the workers that can sustain growth in the future?
Well, they don't have the same demographic pattern that they had 30 years ago. As we know, you know, what the one-child policy had a very dramatic effect on available labor. So that was compensated for by moving people off the land and into the cities, and they were the cheap labor that fueled all that. Now, they're running out of that, too. You know, they're a majority urban population. There are still people left in the countryside. They tend to be either the very old or the very young. So the middle generation is already in the cities. So there is a labor problem. And certainly we've seen labor shortages in certain parts of China for quite some time now, 10, 15 years, there have been labor shortages on the eastern seaboard. So that kind of manufacturer which relies on cheap labor has moved steadily west where, you know, it's gone to meet labor rather than expecting the labor to come to it. So the only way that China is going to manage this transition, if it does, is just by getting smarter, by inventing things, by innovation, by all those things. It's not going to happen with a labor force. And if you contrast that with India, where you've got a very different demographic, you have a very young population there. And so, you know, that demographic advantage has passed to India, which is still growing and growing rather faster than China at present.
A lot of Westerners say of the Chinese, as they said earlier, of the Japanese, that they just can't innovate. They're good copiers, but not innovators. What do you make of that?
Well, I think that remains to be seen. You know, you can argue the cultural point that Chinese education tends to teach people to learn, but not to think. And that is certainly true. Some people believe that Western education has gone too far in the other direction, that people are taught to think, but they don't learn enough. So we have that debate here in the UK, and I'm sure you have it in the US. It's also true, I think, that the kind of innovative spirit also requires, you know, an ecology in which to flourish. And that ecology is, it needs to be relatively safe to take risk. You know, in the United States, startups come, they go, they come again. You know, people can be serial startuppers, whereas in China, that's relatively rare. The kind of small businesses that really thrive tend to be traders rather than manufacturers. But there are one or two very big companies that are part of the new economy. So the digital economy, for instance, you have things like Baidu, the search engine, or WeChat. You know, you have Chinese equivalents of Western websites or Western apps. And often they are rather better. You know, they have functions that the Western apps don't have. Now, they have a huge captive market to practice on and to learn from. But, you know, they do make it. So it's not that Chinese can't innovate. But I do think that the economy of China and the politics of China don't make it particularly easy for innovation to happen. So the Chinese approach tends to be to put a lot of money into research and development. So, you know, in the 12th five-year plan, you had a lot of state investments in research, and that's, you know, that can produce results. But the kind of Bill Gates or Steve Jobs, you know, starting out in the garage and building an empire, I think that's a little harder to see.
It's kind of hard to argue with a government that has engineered probably the greatest economic growth tear in the history of the world. But there are doubts lately that the authorities are competent to manage the challenges of the current situation. Are they? What do you think of the skill of the Chinese leadership?
Well, I think, you know, running China is not easy. But if you were to look at the model of the first 30 years, you know, I've never really been partial to the view that this was a miracle, because what it is a very large version of the Asian tiger story. So others had trod this path before. And if you look at those countries when they get to a certain middle income level, you know, $11,000 average income kind of thing, they undergo certain transitions. And those transitions are driven, you know, by economic change, and they're driven by the political and social demands of the people. So you did have political transitions at that point in South Korea, in Taiwan, even in Japan, where people begin to demand that power is shared more widely across society. However you organize that, that's kind of basically what the demand is. That happens, and some countries avoided the middle income trap. Others, like Japan, really didn't, you know, along long doldrums. This is very tricky stuff. And it's even trickier if you have a continent-sized economy like China, where you have tremendous disparities in prosperity between, you know, the far west and the east coast, where you basically have a shortage of almost everything. So the only thing that China has in abundance is people. And as we've discussed, a lot of them are getting old and becoming a bit of a burden. But it's short of just about everything else. It's short of agricultural land. It's short of water. It's short of natural resources. So they're going to have to be very nimble to make it second time round in the second phase of this economic growth. Their advantage is that they have a big market to play with. So in theory, you know, they ought to be able to exploit that. But it is tricky stuff. And I think that what we've seen with the stock market is not encouraging. You know, they're going to have to learn, I think, to trust markets a little bit more and to take the consequences if they go a little bit wrong. What they've done, in fact, is to criminalize things like short selling, and really just to shut the market down with rather badly designed circuit breakers in the most recent example, but before that with administrative measures. That's not building confidence in the future.
And I imagine the leadership of the party is not very eager to give up its power, but what that process of marketization you described does require them to give up power. Are they caught in an irreconcilable contradiction?
You could say that in spades. And I think that really until Xi Jinping, what we were seeing was a gradual and fairly orderly process of a transfer of power to different sectors in China. So you had, you know, the building up of a legal system. You had the, you know, private enterprise was allowed, if not, you know, if it was facing certain hurdles, but certainly capitalists were admitted to the Communist Party. You know, all of this kind of process was going on. There was a great growth in diversity in media and big, what had formerly been party-supported and state-supported newspapers were expected to appeal to their readers. So, you know, freedom of information went up several notches. Civil society went up several notches. All these symptoms of, you know, a political economy and a political system that was, you know, beginning to share power in all kinds of ways. When we get to Xi Jinping, though, suddenly this goes into reverse. So in all of those respects, things have got tighter, more difficult. The security services have grown stronger and have assumed, you know, a fairly dead hand over things like civil society. And you have all kinds of middle ground being closed down. And this is about the party's anxiety about its own power. So they're trying to reinforce a top-down authoritarian system and create a 21st century economy. No one's ever really done that. So I think there are still a lot of question marks over whether that can be pulled off.
And then finally, there are some of the more excitable commentators in the West have been viewing events in China as their equivalent of 1929. Is anything like that happening?
Not yet. I think, though, you know, we will see more trouble. One difference, though, with the Chinese economy is that a lot of this is, you know, self-contained, if you like. So there is a lot of debt, but it doesn't connect to the international system. So you're not going to see a run on the renminbi. I mean, they are trying to, you know, allow the renminbi, the Chinese currency, to move a little bit. But you're not going to see the kind of raiding of reserves that you see in a more open financial system. So they're protected by still having a lot of, you know, very high fences between them and the outside world. So it really remains to be seen how much bankruptcy we'll see. I don't think we're going to see big state-owned enterprises going bankrupt. What will happen with local government debt, you know, is very interesting. I think that, you know, China's going to have to, you know, just swallow a lot of that. So it's going to have a more of a stifling effect on the economy, I think, rather than people jumping out of skyscrapers because they've suddenly lost their fortunes. The people who are losing their fortunes have largely been caught up in the anti-corruption drive. And that's, you know, another story. But that has targeted a lot of people in a lot of sectors and a lot of people with a lot of money. But, you know, they don't jump out of windows because they're already in detention.
That was Isabel Hilton, editor of the website ChinaDialogue.net. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to KPFA.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. One of the disadvantages of doing a weekly show, in contrast to the great advantage of it being a lot less work, is that you're often a few days behind the curve. In this case, the curve is the death of David Bowie, someone whose music and persona I've loved for more years than I feel like counting. Since I adore almost everything he did, from his early hippie days to his final, almost posthumous album Black Star, it's hard to choose what to play. Here's one of my very favorites, not only a marvelous tune, but an early challenge to what we now call the gender binary. That was some of Queen Bitch by David Bowie from 1971. Next, Chris Misano. On Monday, January 11, the Supreme Court, an institution I passionately despise as an anti-democratic tool of reaction, heard arguments in the case Friedrichs versus California Teachers Association, a challenge to the agency shop in public sector unionism. Under an agency shop model, workers don't have to join the union, but they do have to pay something called an agency fee to compensate for the union's costs of collective bargaining. The right has been aching to destroy this arrangement for a long time in order to cut pay and undermine the political power of public sector unions. Here's Chris Maizano, author of a piece on the Jacobin Magazine website, jacobinmag.com, to tell us more.
Welcome, Chris. Let's start by filling us in on what this case is, the Friedrichs case.
So the Friedrichs case is the latest, probably not the last, in the line of anti-labor lawsuits brought by various forces on the right, legal outfits funded by right-wing and conservative forces to undermine what remains of the power of labor in the United States. So on Monday, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in the case Friedrichs versus California Teachers Association. In 2013, this right-wing legal outfit called the Center for Individual Rights, they filed suit in the California court on behalf of something like 10 teachers led by a person named Rebecca Friedrichs, who's a kindergarten teacher, and an organization called the Christian Educators Association International. So the claim here by the plaintiffs is that the sum that they pay to the CTA to represent them at the bargaining table, which is called an agency fee, violates their First Amendment rights to free speech and association. So the big argument here is that collective bargaining in the public sector is inherently political, and that even though they can opt out of making financial contributions to the union's kind of more straightforwardly political activities like electoral politics, campaign contributions, and stuff like that, even though they can opt out of those contributions, they argue that the procedures, the opt-out procedures, are overly burdensome, and there's like an inertia effect, and a lot of people wind up contributing to political activities that otherwise might not do it. So in their view, public employees shouldn't be required to give any money to a union whose political actions that they disagree with, and they ask the court to abolish what's called the agency shop in the public sector in all states and replace that with what's essentially a right-to-work regime in all 50 states in the public sector. The private sector wouldn't be affected by this, so it's, again, another instance of the sort of public-private split that we see a lot in labor law and the labor movement in general, I guess, in the United States.
Public sector unions had until at least recently, been one of the brighter spots in a rather dismal labor picture. With private sector unionism on the verge of disappearing, the public sector was a bastion of strength. But that's been changing over the last 5 or so years, right?
Yeah. People tend to still conflate the labor movement as a whole with the private sector labor movement, which is a little unfortunate and kind of clouds the situation in the public sector, which has been different for a long time for many reasons. Union density in the public sector overall has stayed more or less constant for some decades now, since basically the 1980s, if I'm recalling this correctly. Overall, public sector union density has hovered around 35, 36, 37% for quite some time, for at least a couple of decades. That varies when you're talking about, you know, which level, depends on which level of government you're talking about. In the federal sector, actually the entire federal sector is right to work. It's voluntary union membership. The postal unions still have pretty high density. The unions elsewhere in the federal government tend to do a fairly good job of keeping members on board voluntarily, but it's lower than in the postal unions. State and local government is where you see a lot of the really high numbers, especially local government. The overall union density rate in local government is still around 40%, and if you look at some states, it gets really high. New York, for example, where I live, has about 70% public sector union density rate. That's the highest. It's been the highest for a long time. It's been around 70% for a long time. There are some other states with very high union densities at around 50% or above that. So, yeah, those figures in the public sector, those density figures, those membership rates in the public sector have been fairly elevated for quite some time, and they had been pretty constant up until 2010. In 2010, the Republicans just absolutely crushed the Democrats in the state-level elections of that year, took control of both chambers in the state legislature in something like 25, 26 states, took the governor's mansion in places like Ohio, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and immediately just started going after public sector unions. Of course, they were aided in many instances by Democrats, so it was something of a bipartisan affair. Governor Andrew Cuomo springs immediately to mind for me because I live in New York, but you know, the most egregious forays against public sector labor were carried out by Republican governors and state legislators, with you know, Wisconsin being kind of the biggest example of that.
Yeah, Walker really kicked this all off, really, right?
Yeah, that was really the first big move. You know, he gets elected at the end of 2010 with a majority, Republican majority in the state house. And yeah, they go right away. And, you know, if I'm remembering this correctly, during the campaign, he, you know, made some noises about, you know, I don't really want to go after labor, blah, blah, blah. This is a distraction. And lo and behold, not too long after they came into power, you know, they went right to work on, you know, going after the public sector unions. You know, met with huge protests, obviously. I'm sure people listening to the show remember that. You know, indefinite protests and occupations at the state house. But, you know, ultimately they won. They saw it through. They pushed through the law in 2011. And since then, you know, public sector unions in the state of Wisconsin have just, you know, they've taken a beating. AFSCME, which is the state and county and municipal employees union, has lost something like 40,000 members since then. They've lost all kinds of revenues, millions of dollars in revenues lost, big staff layoffs, all kinds of problems. You know, and that was just the public sector. In 2015, last year, they pushed through a statewide right-to-work law, which also affected the private sector. So right now, I mean, the situation there in Wisconsin is really bad. But yeah, he was the one that really kicked it off in early 2011, and then others followed suit elsewhere.
And stunningly, Michigan, which a lot of people think of as a, you know, real union bastion and the birthplace of modern unionism, in Flint, that went right to work.
Yeah, Michigan went right to work in 2012 after it happened in Indiana. And yeah, you're right. That was a completely stunning development. I mean, that's the cradle of the United Auto Workers. This is the really the birthplace of kind of 20th century unionism in the United States. You know, the UAW was probably the most important union in the U.S. for decades and decades. So to see Michigan, of all places, go right to work was just absolutely incredible, really, in the worst possible way. It's worth noting that that happened after the unions there made a push to enshrine collective bargaining rights in the state constitution through a referendum. They failed. And when they failed, you know, the Republicans in the state moved not too long thereafter to push through the law.
And there have also been a series of court cases that have done a whole lot of damage to the public sector unions leading up to this Friedrichs one, right?
Right. That's right. Yeah, the situation, I guess, legally, and I'm no legal expert, but, you know, I've just been following this pretty closely, so I've learned some stuff about kind of the case law here and the jurisprudence. So I guess it for a long time, you know, the law in this regard had been, you know, fairly settled since the 1977 decision in Abood versus the Detroit Board of Education, which recognized the constitutionality of agency shops in the public sector. So, you know, that had stayed pretty constant for quite some time. No one really went after it until a few years ago. So in 2012, there was a case called Knox versus SEIU Local 1000, and that was about special assessments for political activity. So I think this was an SEIU local, and I believe it was in California, that was, you know, imposing a special assessment on their members to fund various political activities. So somebody filed suit against that, and the court ruled in their favor and said that the union couldn't do it unless they got the affirmative consent from members to do so. So instead of an opt-out procedure for, you know, these sort of special political assessments, there would have to be an opt-in procedure. That majority opinion was written by Alito, Justice Alito.
Excuse the abrupt transition here. A technical glitch ate up a few seconds of audio. Maizano is describing how Alito went out of his way in his opinion to invite broader challenges to public sector unionism. Continuing.
All these arguments against the reasoning that underpinned the 1977 Abood ruling, you know, basically saying that there's no constitutional or legal justification for permitting, you know, a union to collect fees from non-members. So what the unions always say is that we need to do this to prevent free riding. So he's saying, you know, you can't use the free riding argument to violate First Amendment rights. That was his argument. And, you know, by putting that argument or that opinion in the ruling on the Knox case, basically he just signaled to every right-wing anti-union legal outfit in the country that it was open season on the Abood precedent. So obviously people saw that and, you know, they started filing lawsuits in the federal courts to go after Abood. So the next one after that was Harris v. Quinn, which was a case that came before the Supreme Court in 2014. That was a 5-4 ruling, and again, Alito, you know, he wrote the majority opinion. In that case, that involved home health care workers in Illinois. One of the members there in SEIU, Pamela Harris, who's, you know, was the lead plaintiff there, said that, you know, they shouldn't be required to, you know, pay fees to SEIU. So she filed suit with the support of some right-wing legal groups, and they said that since these home health care workers, you know, they said that they were not full-fledged public employees, they were quasi-public employees, some separate class of workers, they therefore were not covered by Abood. So immediately SEIU had to stop collecting agency fee payments from those workers, and something like 13,000 of them dropped their membership in the union. So again, they didn't go the whole hog and get rid of agency shops in there entirely and do national right to work, but again, they used the occasion of the majority opinion, and Alito wrote it again, to basically say Abood was bad law, it should be overturned, you know, inviting yet another case to come before the court so that they can try to go even further. So Friedrichs, which was just under argued on Monday, a couple days ago, it's that case. It sped through the lower courts. The plaintiffs did something really unusual. As it was making its way through the lower courts, they just asked judges to rule against them on the basis of precedent so that they could get up to the Supreme Court faster. And they did that. So, you know, all the lower court judges ruled against them. It got up to the Supreme Court in 2 years, which is really quick. Last summer, they decided to hear it. We'll get a ruling on that no later than June.
But given the history of this court, we should expect the worst, I'm guessing.
Yeah, that's what it looks like. You know, this court does not have a very good record on the many things. Their First Amendment jurisprudence shows that they consider money to be speech. You know, we saw that in campaign finance cases like Citizens United. And, yeah, it was clear from a lot of the questioning on Monday that it seems like they've got a majority to, you know, say that agency fees are compelled speech. So, yeah, it's not looking good. You know, I was reading some reports online about the session, about the arguments. You know, I saw words like bloodbath being thrown around. So, yeah, based on what we saw in the questioning, it's not looking good. You know, obviously the questioning isn't necessarily totally predictive. You know, you can see questioning look like you're going to get one opinion or one ruling, and then you get something else when the ruling actually comes out. But based on what we know about this court, based on what we know about kind of the long history of the labor movement and the courts, I don't think that we should expect anything probably less than national rhetoric in the public sector at this point. It just doesn't look good.
I'm speaking with Chris Maizano, who is the author of a piece on the Jacobin Magazine website about the assault on public sector unions. And this agency fee we've been speaking about, this is a quirk that's different from private sector arrangements and has something to do with the history of the organization of public employee unions, which came decades after the private sector. So, yeah, run down that history and how we got to the agency fee.
Yeah, sure. So in the 1930s when, you know, we saw to that point one of the biggest upsurges in working class militancy and organization, you know, that had ever happened in the country, when Congress passed the National Labor Relations Act in 1935, it specifically excluded public employees from its protections. I mean, up until then, and, you know, for some time thereafter, public sector unions were looked on as totally illegitimate, that they were threats to public order, that they could potentially undermine state sovereignty. So at that point, not only were they not included in the NLRA or in the Wagner Act, you know, as a lot of people may know it as, you know, in most states, they did not have the legal right to organize, to collectively bargain and strike. So once they were excluded from the federal law, public sector workers and their unions, you know, they became subject to sort of a patchwork system of state and local laws that varied widely on a regional basis. So basically, the Northeast, Upper Midwest, West Coast, eventually public sector unions were able to make some inroads and gain some legal rights and all the rest of it, but, you know, still to this day are largely locked out of many southern states. You know, there are still some states where public sector unions can't legally collectively bargain and things like that. In addition, you know, many states, you know, and this includes New York and many others, they passed laws banning strikes in the public sector. So through basically the 1950s, strikes by public sector workers are illegal. There is very few state and local governments giving public employees the legal right to form unions, engage in collective bargaining. You're not seeing a ton of workplace militancy. Strike activity is pretty rare. And, you know, at that time, the wages and working conditions for public sector workers, you know, they paled in comparison to those that you would find in the relatively highly unionized private sector. So that situation starts to change in the 60s and 70s. So during this time, public workers get caught up kind of in the general social radicalization of the time, and, you know, they start joining unions. They start launching strikes, really in unprecedented numbers. This includes white and blue collars alike, and actually blue-collar public workers, you know, did a lot of this. People tend to think of white public sector workers as white-collar predominantly, but that's not always the case. Blue-collar workers were very involved in this upsurge as well. So, you know, during this period from, say, the late 50s through about 1970 or so, you see strike activity just explode. You see the membership ranks of the teachers' unions, of AFSCME, of other public sector unions just increase very dramatically. I think AFSCME goes from a pretty small union to over a million during this period. The AFT, the American Federation of Teachers, goes from like something like 60,000 to about 200,000, you know, in about 10 years. So you start to see really huge membership gains during that time. And still during this period, you know, you didn't have much of a sort of legal institutional structure at this point to sort of regulate public sector unions, to regulate their relations with government employers and all the rest of it. So all these gains, or many of these gains, are kind of taking place in a context, you know, where the law really, there wasn't much of it at that time. You know, kind of a lot of these activities had, you know, operated under a cloud of legal uncertainty. You weren't sure if it was actually legal to do a lot of things the unions were doing. And, you know, they were making gains kind of in spite of the law or in defiance of it instead of through it. When all this is going on, you're seeing all this unprecedented militancy, illegal strikes in many cases, you know, workers joining unions en masse. You know, you start to see government employers pushing back. They want some relief from all the labor unrest, but at the same time, you know, you see a lot of union leaders wanting to consolidate those membership gains because, you know, it should be noted during this period, union membership in the public sector was largely voluntary. You know, by this time in the private sector, you see a lot of things like union shops where, you know, you've got to join union within some period of time. A lot of times it's like 30 days. Within 30 days of getting hired in a job where there's a union, otherwise, you know, you can get kicked out of the union and therefore, you know, lose your job. So that was fairly common in the private sector, but it was not common in the public sector. So, you know, up until about the late 1950s or so, union membership in public sector unions was more or less voluntary. Workers joined the union where it existed if they wanted to. They could drop out or not choose, or choose not to join it if they wanted to as well. So on the one hand, that created a lot of financial and organizational uncertainty and insecurity for the unions. But on the other hand, in order to attract and retain members, in a lot of cases, they would have to wage mass struggles against the employers to do that, to make gains, to attract members and all the rest of it. During this period, we see the employers wanting to tamp down on unrest, stop strike activity, you know, bring some more order, I guess, to the workplace. And then on the other, you see union leaders wanting to consolidate these membership gains and deal with the sort of financial and legal uncertainty that comes from voluntary union membership. So for both sides, this kind of compromise that's sort of represented in the agency shop becomes more and more attractive. So, you know, you start to see agency shops negotiated in collective bargaining, and that's intended to both recognize the growing power of the unions, but it's also intended to channel rank-and-file militancy and organization into a kind of more bureaucratic forms of activity like the grievance procedure, routinized collective bargaining, and all the rest of it. So, yeah, you don't kind of see these arrangements until sort of the late 60s, early 70s, and that's when things start to really change.
Now, let's just fast forward to the present and look at some of the political issues involved here. One of the problems for labor, public sector unions, with the broader public is that, I don't know, it seems to me that they don't make really a case for their existence. To a lot of workers who don't have benefits, don't have security, they look with envy at the public sector workers who have benefits and security, and they resent it. What could the unions have done differently to prevent that tension from developing?
It's a good question. You know, I don't know if I have necessarily a great set of answers to that, but, you know, I think it's worth looking at this period, you know, for some clues. I mean, I'll use the example of kind of New York City as a sort of case study here. So during, you know, the 60s, you see a lot of unrest, a lot of militancy in the public sector in New York. You know, there's a range of unions, you know, vying for members, for influence, competing with each other for members and influence within the public sector, going on strike, doing all kinds of things to raise standards, which for, you know, for many public sector workers in this period were really low. During the course of these struggles, the city, for example, you know, tried to establish new institutional and legal frameworks in which to sort of, you know, channel and direct these sorts of activities. I'm not going to get into all the details because it's, you know, a pretty long story, but to make a long story short, in New York, which wound up happening, what wound up happening is that, you know, some of the unions that were trying to make broader demands around kind of the quality of public services, the level of public services, the implementation and design in public services, and tried to get, you know, kind of public service recipients or clients involved in the bargaining or in the activities of unions to some extent. And, you know, social service workers in New York are a good example of that. The new sorts of institutional arrangements and labor relations systems that were put in place kind of explicitly put those subjects outside of the legal scope of bargaining and union activity. So some of that was done more or less in collaboration with some of the unions that were really trying to establish themselves as the leading unions in the city. So part of it is, you know, kind of an employer strategy to put those sorts of more explosive demands, you know, outside of the formal legal and institutional framework. And then some of it is, you know, unions looking to curry favor with the employer by accepting those sorts of limitations and restrictions so that they can get forms of security in return. So in New York, you see that happening. I think that sort of process played out similarly in a lot of cases. So, yeah, there was a period in which, you know, those sorts of activities among public sector unions were more common. But you start to see that changing during this period in which, you know, unions are getting the agency shop. They are, you know, establishing, you know, themselves as exclusive bargaining agents. And, you know, once they gain these forms of institutional, organizational security, then you start to see them move away from these sorts of, like, broader social demands and political projects that, you know, some of the unions in the public sector were trying to put on the agenda before then.
So, and finally, if this agency model is destroyed, we'll probably see something like what happened in Wisconsin and elsewhere, where the public sector unions lose members like crazy. What will they have to do to turn that around or face certain death or what?
Well, it's worth pointing out that Act 10, the law in Wisconsin that really decimated the public sector unions there, that went a lot further than just getting rid of, you know, the agency shop or those sorts of forms of union security. It really radically restricted the legal scope of what unions could bargain over. So at this point, there's almost no point in joining a union if you're a public sector worker in Wisconsin because unions can't legally address a whole range of issues that are going to be important to you. So, you know, a lot of workers have just decided it's not worth it. They've dropped out, and, you know, the membership rates have plummeted there. The worst-case scenario with this Supreme Court case wouldn't do that. It would, you know, unions would still have legal rights to bargain over all those subjects that they've been bargaining over up until now. They would lose the agency shop. Obviously, yeah, immediately if that happens, whoever is an agency fee payer is not a full-fledged member of the union, the unions would have to stop collecting those payments on their behalf. So depending on the union, that could be a pretty large percentage of their income, or it could be smaller. It all depends on what the unions are able to do in terms of signing up agency fee payers to become full-fledged members before the ruling comes. After that, members are going to be able to drop at any time, and you can be sure that right-wing groups are going to be calling, mailing members to tell them, hey, you know, you can drop at any time. You could save on that dues money. You know, the unions haven't even been getting you big wage increases at the bargaining table recently anyway, so why be a member? Drop your membership and save the money. So it's likely that, yeah, a lot of unions are going to see some significant membership declines if that happens. Because people will be able to drop at any time, it's likely that, you know, those losses will just kind of accelerate and set off a vicious cycle, and that unions are going to have a really tough time adjusting. Really, you know, the only potential silver lining here is that the loss of these or the potential loss of these sorts of forms of union security are going to force unions to do the things that they should have been doing a long time ago, which is re-engage their members, increase membership participation, increase internal union democracy, all the rest of it so that people want to be part of a union voluntarily. And then they see the value in paying dues even when there's no legal compulsion to do so. If they don't do that, if we can't do that, then, yeah, the future of the labor movement in the United States is fairly – it's not great, at least in the short run. But people, and myself included, are holding out hope that at least in the longer run, this is an impetus to making the changes that need to be made.
I was Chris Maizano, author of a piece on the Friedrichs case, a challenge to public sector unionism now before the Supreme Court, which is published on the Jacobin Magazine website. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, more David Bowie, this Sons of the Silent Age from 1977. Till next week, bye.
Sons of the Silent Age, listen to tracks by Santhropy and King Dice. Sons of the Silent Age, pick up in bars and cry only once. Sons of the Silent Age, make love only once, but dream and dream. Don't walk, they just glided and out of life. They never died, they just go to sleep.